Guantanamo Bay Naval Base. Located on the southeast corner of Cuba, about 400 miles from Miami, Florida, this base stretches across 45 square miles of land and water. But located within this area lies a highly secretive and highly controversial detention camp, often referred to as Gitmo. Established by President George W. Bush in 2002, horrifying tales of torture and death have plagued its short history. As this military prison housed some of the world's most dangerous terrorists, at least 8 of them died while incarcerated. The DOD claims at least 6 were by suicide. But were they? My guest today is author Jeffrey Kay. In his book, Cover Up at Guantanamo, Jeffrey explores 2 of these mysterious deaths, detailing meticulously declassified military documents. Horrifying tales of drugs possibly used for interrogation purposes, the lack of basic human rights, and strong evidence of a massive cover-up of the truth. Buckle up, you're about to journey inside the Black Vault. That's right, everybody. As always, thank you so much for tuning in and making this your podcast or your live stream of choice. Today, I'm doing something a little bit different. It's a topic I've wanted to cover, but never have on this show. And back in March of this year, I reached out to my guest, Jeffrey Kay, who is pretty much the foremost expert in the world on what is going on at Gitmo and the controversies and essentially the cover-up. As I mentioned in the introduction, he wrote Cover-Up at Guantanamo. It's a great book that we are going to dive into today. But Jeffrey, thank you so much for taking your time and joining me today.
Thanks, John. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Absolutely. And like I just said, I've wanted to do this for quite some time. COVID is pretty much to blame for a lot of things, and I was unable to do a lot of shows. So I appreciate your patience with all of that as my technological end got sent into array, but then it was just scheduling. So I do appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Before we really dive into your book, because this is going to get, I know, very, very in depth, I want you to just give my audience a little bit of a background on Guantanamo Bay, the military prison there, and ultimately, what was Gitmo supposed to be, and what did it become?
Right. Well, first, let me say, well, I appreciate you calling me the world's foremost authority on Guantanamo. I don't think of myself as such. I would direct your listeners to the work of Andy Worthington, a journalist in the United Kingdom, who has written a book and has been on the Guantanamo case forever, since things began. And he would be the foremost authority in my mind. And Guantanamo, of course, itself opened almost 19 years ago now. It's hard to believe an entire generation of people. People are coming into adulthood who were born when this prison was already operational. And as people will remember, it is, in a way, it's the child of the 9/11 terrorist attack and its aftermath in the United States, however you want to think of that. No matter what you think about whatever 9/11 was or what happened afterwards, the United States invaded Afghanistan and began a so-called war on terror. And in doing so, they sent out special forces, CIA, and other military units to capture and interdict supposed terrorist cells, armies, Al-Qaeda, the Afghan government, where the United States still, of course, is in Afghanistan to this day. And people. Besides killing people, they also began to pick up prisoners. And they, supposedly, the story goes, they needed a place to interrogate these prisoners, which is and hold them. A lot of that was done within Afghanistan itself, places like Bagram Air Base. They looked around for a facility to be what they would think of as a strategic interrogation center. What that means is this is a place in which high-level interrogations were going to take place. But really what was also going to take place was experimentation about interrogation, as it turned out. And I believe, although I can't prove it, no one can prove it yet, was pretty much one of the main reasons why they sought out to open Guantanamo and put it in the places they put it would be beyond the reach, as they thought, of the law, right? And that these...
Mm-hmm. Well, I was just going to ask, so then how long after it opened and you had kind of this public image of what it was, how long after did that controversy start to arise? Was it immediate? Was it a few years? And how did that happen?
It was almost immediate. I mean, people in government knew what was going on and the discussions that were taking place. And within a year, certainly already articles were beginning to appear in the Washington Post, the New York Times. Nothing too alarmist. They were fairly positive about what was going on and what needed to be done. And a lot of it was just stenography for the government. You know, government gave the press conference. DOD spokesperson said something, and the press duly reported it. A little bit was leaking out that maybe things weren't so kosher, or that this was a little odd to use it. But Guantanamo had, in fact, been used as a detention center previously. It had been used as a detention center for Haitians who were fleeing terror in within their own country in Haiti, and also for Cubans who had Castro let people out of the prisons, and there was a flood of refugees headed to the United States. So Guantanamo had been tasked with being a penal facility of some sort already. But this was something new. And in fact, they expected, as a report I recently did showed that I obtained by FOIA, that they were taking people, as we know, from the battlefield, literally, and then flying them halfway around the world to Cuba, to their base that the U.S. stole from the Cuban government, putting people there, and they fully expected some of them to die. And as we get into it, we'll see that it's very possible that some of them did die, and we don't even know who those people were. But that's another aspect of the whole story. They were put in Guantanamo. They were called, today they call them unprivileged combatants. Enemy combatants. I forget the exact term Bush used. The terms have changed over the years. But the primary thing for your listeners to understand is that the United States maintained that the prisoners they were bringing to Guantanamo were outside of the Geneva Conventions. Just like the people going into the CIA black site prisons at the same time that were set up in Thailand, and Poland, and Lithuania, etc., different parts of the world, whisked there by extraordinary rendition airplanes that were chartered for that purpose, just as DOD kidnapped people and brought them to the United States without any hearings, without any determination of guilt, and with no possibility at that time, so they thought, of seeing an attorney to get themselves help, with no way to reach their families, truly thrown into a place where there was no hope. And no communication, and subjected them to a program of intense psychological torture and physical torture as well. And they did this by, in part, changing the rules about what, the Bush administration, this is the first, this is George W. Bush administration, got legal, their own Department of Justice and their Attorney General to rule that these people were not real prisoners. They were, again, enemy combatants. The prisoner of war rules of the Geneva Conventions did not apply to them. they changed is Jason Leopold, the journalist now with BuzzFeed, but who I worked with on this issue, you know, more than, about 10 years ago or whatever now, changed rules about what were considered experimentation by the Department of Defense, about who had a right to make such experiments on prisoners. And they sent them to Guantanamo. Everyone who was sent there had a scopolamine patch put behind their ear. Some of your listeners might know that scopolamine was investigated by the CIA as a truth drug back in the 1940s and during World War II. If you watch old movies about World War II, essentially sometimes it'll pop up. Oh, give them scopolamine. You know, that'll make them talk. Mm-hmm. What it does, it makes you, I took it once on an ocean voyage on a small boat, and it makes you nauseous. I threw up. I took it off. I was better off without the scopolamine patch than I was with it as a preventative to seasickness, and which was what the patch is for. And in fact, the U.S. Coast Guard determined the same thing. They weren't going to let their own people use it unless they wanted to, because it made people sick. But it didn't matter. They weren't going to test out or ask any of these prisoners. They put the scopolamine patch on them, and when they arrived, you know, and were hooded, of course, they were chained the whole way. They were terrorized. They didn't know where they were going, and arrived at Guantanamo in this hot place. Were put, you know, many people have seen the famous photos of the orange jumpsuits, mm-hmm. and the goggles. You couldn't see what they were seeing. And their hands were padded. You know, why couldn't they, you know, they couldn't see, they couldn't hear, they had earmuffs on. Earmuffs, what were they afraid they were going to hear? Well, this is a form today, they call that field expedient separation. It's in the Army Field Manual, which the United States Congress has made under force of law the interrogation guidelines for U.S. government, military, and CIA. And it's a form of sensory deprivation. The United States government, primarily the CIA, spent a decade or more researching and looking at how sensory deprivation can affect the human mind and the human body, and in particular, how that would affect a prisoner in their held in their capacity, whether that would make them talk more, or how it would affect them, and whether it, how quickly it could help break them down, which was the main point. And that's what they wanted to do, break these prisoners down. They were all put in isolation. Although at first there was some chaos, they were first put, of course, in Camp X-Ray, which was a bunch of cells, I mean, just like pens, chain link pens, in which they were in chains, mm-hmm. and exposed to the elements, and treated like really the guinea pigs that they were, like animals.
How much?
And hundreds, of course. Yes.
How much of this was general public knowledge? That's the first part of my question. But then this doesn't entirely sound sanctioned by every corner of the U.S. government. So can you talk to me a little, and maybe it was, correct me if I'm wrong, but can you talk to me a little bit before we drill into the cases themselves? Yeah. About how much secrecy surrounded what truly was going on about how they were treating these prisoners that were going down to Gitmo.
Well, there was tremendous secrecy. And if it hadn't been for a few pictures leaking out, in particular those pictures of the men in the orange jumpsuits with the earmuffs and the goggles, you know, people would have believed what the government was telling them. They were treated humanely. They were treated, even though they weren't part of the Geneva Convention, the president had decided, let's treat them as if they were. So why did they go to the trouble of saying that they weren't?
Yeah.
Why go to the trouble of making them not Geneva-style prisoners, only to say, well, we'll treat them as if they were? Because, of course, that was a lie. They needed the legal cover to do that. And it wasn't really until some months went by, and the inside Guantanamo itself, some people began to protest about what they were seeing happening. One of the most prominent, of course, was Mark Fallon, who was a member of the Criminal Investigative Task Force. He was originally with NCIS, the Naval Criminal Investigative Service, of which your listeners may know from watching the TV show. It's on a popular show for many years. I've actually never seen an episode.
Neither have I. I'm with you there.
Very popular. Yes. 9 seasons. I don't know how many seasons. but he was with them for years, and there was a part of the personnel who had gone into Guantanamo was full of spooks. CIA, the Department of the BOD's investigative arm, intelligence arm, the DIA, the FBI, you know, an NCIS, which is another criminal. And there were people who were there to get supposedly intelligence about future terrorist attacks, was the idea, was what they told the public. And some people were there to get information so that one, they could prosecute, you know, criminally, mm-hmm. you know, people who had made terrorist attacks or threats against the United States. Mark Fallon was one of these criminal investigators who was in, and he saw the torture being done, said, you know, hey, this is not going to look good. You know, this isn't right. And there, he was joined by a few other people as well, higher up. And, but their protests went nowhere. And they were basically shunted aside, and the regime of Gitmo continued. It did leak out, though, some to the press as a result, but it took years. But by 2007, 2008, now we're already 6 or so years into the presence of Gitmo. The hearings were finally held at the Senate Armed Services Committee. Mm-hmm. And at that point, and really a year or so before that, enough was leaking out and going into the press. There was a landmark article published at Vanity Fair called Rorschach and Awe. And it talked about, you know, psychologists being involved in interrogations, and that they were operating something like Operation Phoenix in Vietnam, or they were, you know, they were doing bad stuff to mm-hmm. people. But I don't think people at that point, I can't remember exactly when the whole waterboarding aspect came out at the CIA. You know, again, there was two things going on. There was Guantanamo, and of course, there was the CIA. They're not totally separate because, of course, the CIA operated a black site at Guantanamo off and on, or perhaps the whole time. I don't know. They don't tell me.
Yeah.
But apparently,
it's
off
not
and
in
on
the pamphlet,
at
huh?
Guantanamo.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, people were whisked in and out, and they also, another person who wrote, I want to give credit to, is Jane Mayer early on. A New Yorker did an article, again about, how these people were using, you know, coercive kinds of interrogation drawn from something that, most people had never heard of if I hadn't been in the military, called SEER. SEER is a program in the military, and it stands for Survival, Evasion, Resistance, Escape. And it's a program in which military members are taught how to survive captivity when captured, and or interrogated and or tortured was the idea. And the program itself supposedly got its start after the Korean War, when soldiers were captured, and some of them collaborated with the Chinese and North Koreans. And some of them, a subset of those who were Air Force pilots, some of them quite high-ranking colonels, testified that the United States had used biological weapons in Korea, and therefore had committed, you know, grievous war crimes. And the United States said this was brainwashing. Perhaps people have heard of the Manchurian Candidate mm-hmm. and the famous movie or book Search for the Manchurian Candidate. It's all about how the communists brainwash people to confess to things that are false. And so now it turns out the SEER program originated before all this, before the Korean War. But
wow.
That's not the story they want to tell.
Yeah.
So the story, though, is that, and this is what you'll read in the New York Times today. Scott Shane, reporter there, you know, has reported this, other reporters, you know, that these communist forms of inducing false confessions were then picked up and reverse engineered by these two psychologists, James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen, who used them to create a torture program for the CIA. And that somehow or another, the military picked this up as well and began doing pretty much the same thing. And the center point they were doing that was in Afghanistan, places like Bagram, where they were holding detainees and prisoners, and the other was at Guantanamo. And
I want to lead into then a couple of the cases that you deal with in your book, which I mean, I'm guessing is probably connected to all of this research and so on. But these are the suicides or the quote unquote suicides that were acknowledged by the Department of Defense. And again, correct me if I'm wrong, because I don't want to speak for you, but it seems like your research shows that these were not suicides. People that were incarcerated ended up dying. Six of the eight, that was the number I found anyway, but six of the eight were termed suicides. But is there more to the story? Were they actually suicides?
Right. Well, you know, I believe, you know, a human being's death is a unique thing. Each person's death is unique to them, and there are different categories of ways of dying, including dying at the hands of another person or institution. When I looked into the cases that I was able to get documentation on, in particular, and concentrated in my book, Cover Up at Guantanamo, were two detainees, Muhammad al-Hanashi and Abdul Rahman al-Amri. I also looked at the other releases of information and journalistic works on a couple of other, on the other detainees who had committed suicide. Three of them in 2006, famously on the same day, and one of them in 2013, Abdul Latif. And what I found was that some of them looked like outright murder. In particular, the 2006 deaths that were later written up in a very famous article, award-winning article by Scott Horton at Harper's Magazine, and later in a book by Joseph Hickman, who was a guard at Guantanamo and saw some of these events and was there at the time. And there was another, the sixth suicide was a man by the name of Haji Nassim, otherwise known, the DOD called him Inayatullah. And he was a middle-aged gentleman. He was one of the last prisoners to be brought to Guantanamo. And he was he died a suicide in 2011. And it's a number of them died under the Obama administration, by the way, half of them. And were they suicides? No, so I would say the murder of al-Rahman was murder. I mean, the murder. The death of al-Amri, rather, was a murder. Of al-Hanashi, possibly murder, if not suicide by a medical neglect. In other words, what I would call facilitated suicide. In other words, if you're at a medical facility and you know that your prisoner is suicidal, dangerously suicidal, and you provide that person with the means to kill themselves, then you are in fact implicated in their murder, in their death.
So you're saying that they supplied them with information to assist in this, or tools, or what did they supply?
Or they withdrew surveillance of suicidal prisoners. They provided them. They put instruments in their cells that would help them kill themselves. They did not follow standard operating procedures, and nobody cared. They, you know, I was talking before how people were brought to Guantanamo with scopolamine patches. When they arrived, all of them, by the way, were given a drug called mefloquine, every single prisoner brought to Guantanamo, at least through 2006 or 7. Afterwards, I don't have the records, but not many were brought after that anyway. And mefloquine is an anti-malarial drug, quite controversial in the press and in the military. In fact, the military some years ago stopped using it because of its adverse side effects, neuropsychiatric in particular side effects. And of course, they knew that there were problems with this drug, and they gave it in not just prophylactic doses, which is how most people were getting it from the doctors, how U.S. soldiers were getting it, but they gave them a full treatment dose as if they had. It was a presumptive treatment for malaria, every single person prisoner who came there. And of course, remember, they had just been flown around the world. They'd been tortured. Many of them were injured. They were dizzy and nauseous from scopolamine. And they were then given this other drug, which would also cause them a horrific side effect, not for everybody, but for a subset. And in fact, the reason I bring this up again is because in 2006, and in 2007, two of the prisoners who died of supposed suicide were tested for the presence of mefloquine in their bloodstream some years after they were given to them. Well, we know that was given to them upon arrival. But there was no malaria at Guantanamo. There was no malaria in Cuba. Why were these prisoners tested for mefloquine? I believe it was part of one of the experiments that were going on, or it was used as a form of torture. If I know that you're allergic to peanut butter, there's people out there who have peanut butter allergies, anaphylactic shock, or whatever you respond to it, and I know that about you, and you're my prisoner, and I give you peanut butter surreptitiously or just enough of it to cause you to have the symptoms, then that's a form of torture, right? That's a form of, or even of murder if you die. And I believe that's what they did with the mefloquine. They gave everyone mefloquine. They found out which ones had bad side effects, and then they could use that in interrogation or use that to further explore how it might be useful in interrogation. Pretty horrific stuff.
Yeah, and let me ask you, I mean, how many programs do you think are going on at the same time? Because a lot of times the aura around these stories is that this is interrogation. This is for getting information, extracting information. But the more I hear you talk, it's like, sure, that's one program, but it sounds like these guys were guinea pigs going back to like a 1960s MK Ultra, like LSD experiment, take that name away and insert another drug to see what they could do. Are all of these, do you feel, independent programs of what they were researching down there?
There were definitely, I feel confident that there were different programs. You know, in my book, again, Cover Up of Guantanamo, I list six different instances that I was able to discover in which research on detainees and in some cases, discussions about the unethical aspects of doing such research exist on the public record. I mean, all my work is really open source or FOIA-based. Mm-hmm. The only time...
That's why I highly respect you, by the way. Just for the right... Not to interrupt you, but I love that aspect of your work.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. And I'm very appreciative of all the work you've done in this. I mean, really standout work. Very important. And I'm sure I've used some of it as part of this.
I appreciate it.
As well. So at least instances, discussions between members of the National Science Foundation or, a discussion, released, documents showing that, people were told that they had to be read in to get the quote data about the detainees. Other instances in which research, and then each in the two times it came up in the context of an investigation, the investigators said, well, we didn't go any farther because it wasn't our mandate. Like, well, we know that this is happening, but we're not going to look. Mm-hmm. Don't look there. And in fact, no one has really looked there. And, my book's called Cover Up of Guantanamo. And who did the cover up? Well, Guantanamo was set up as, to hide from people's eyes what was going on, just as the CIA black sites were secretive and meant to hide what was going on at them. But even of the many crimes that have taken place, the truth of what has gone on is only partially revealed. What often is called a limited hangout, I guess it's called. Mm-hmm. So I could see, you mentioned about MK Ultra and the different programs. Well, yes, absolutely. And in fact, it turned out, and we only discovered this a couple of years ago, I noticed that, when they did the Senate report on the CIA torture program, if you looked in the footnotes, you would see that the emails about the program are going to an entity known as OTS within the CIA. And OTS stood for the Office of Technical Services. Well, that rang a bell for me, as it might for you, because the Office of Technical Services for many years was the entity within the CIA that ran MKUltra. I said, this is bizarre. Mm-hmm. Why would that entity, which is supposedly all about today, making spy devices like, you know, the Q in a James Bond movie, you know, it's all, oh, we took a clever a pen that has a really has a little secret vial that you could shoot across the room, whatever, you know, that's the kind of thing they do. Well, why were they involved in interrogation of detainees? And in fact, James Mitchell worked for, before 9/11, was working with OTS on something.
Wow.
What was that?
Yeah.
You know, and in fact, if you look at the contracts of Mitchell and Jessen, I'm sorry if I keep throwing this stuff out here.
This is why you're here, because you know yeah. your stuff. So I love it.
You know, Mitchell and Jessen were hired originally because they were doing applied research on detainees.
Wow.
What sort of research? Well, I don't know. I would say research about, MK Ultra kind of stuff. What is MK Ultra? For your listeners, many people don't know. It was a program, one of a number of programs, in fact, that the military and the CIA conducted in the late 1940s and in the 1950s and the 1960s and the 1970s and arguably onward. We know supposedly officially they ended in the 1970s. But in fact, I believe it really did not. And a few years ago, a memoir from the chief of the Office of Medical Services of the CIA was released by part of a FOIA lawsuit by the ACLU. And one of the ways cover-ups happen, by the way, is just by not paying attention. That's a form of cover-up. And the press almost totally ignored it, or they did a spin. Actually, they noticed it, and they noticed that in this memoir, there was a mention about truth drugs. And there were headlines in the press. You can find them just a few years ago. New York Times, Washington Post, Miami Herald, you know, CIA considered using truth drugs on detainees, you know, and there was pious talk about how truth drugs were researched by the CIA over the years. Nothing else. The memoir was about 60, 70 pages long. Was that a 60, 70 page discussion of truth drugs? No, it appeared in a paragraph or so. What about the rest of the memoir? This is why you have to, and I know, John, you appreciate this, you have to read the original documents yourself. And again, I can't thank you so much for putting so many of these documents out there to be read by the public. It's so important. It's what it's also a passion of my own to get the, and in fact, everything I talk about here about where I say I FOIA'd something or the information on the case investigative files on the prisoners who supposedly committed suicide at Guantanamo, I put up at my website, GuantanamoTruth.com. A small caution for people who go there. That site lately has come under quite a bit of attack. It's alternately up and down. So, you know, if you're not getting through, come back in a few days or a week, and hopefully I've got it back operational. But it's, you know, I can't say who's attacking me or what. It could be anybody. It doesn't have to be the government. Could be the government. Could be just people who like to muck around on websites.
Yeah.
Well, right-wing type.
I want to just make one quick comment about the MK Ultra documents and that kind of connection.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I always love to convey to my audience and listeners, and you just did it beautifully and eloquently, but it sounds like history often repeats itself. And that's why I always tell people, sometimes documents from the 40s and 50s and 60s, sometimes it's a little snoozy. Other times it's like, well, that'll never happen again. And yet we see this time and time again, not only with experimentation like this, not only with places like Gitmo and the CIA black sites, but a lot of different arenas where history often repeats itself. One thing I want to cover, we don't have to cover it for long, but we have talked a little bit about the presidential administrations from Bush starting it. And you had made a comment earlier that most of the suicides, we'll use air quotes for suicides, that they happened during the Obama administration. One aspect, half of them.
Yeah.
Okay. So half of them happened during the Obama administration. Now, I don't want to politicize this in the show per se, but I feel that the whole topic has been politicized. And I feel, and correct me if I'm wrong, the coverage of this has seriously waned over the last, I would say, you know, decade or so, where we don't hear about it anymore. I mean, 2020 is all about COVID, yeah. but we don't hear about this anymore.
Right.
And the right. large, what I feel is a myth, but a lot of people believe it, is that Guantanamo was completely shut down because that's what President Obama had promised. But obviously that is right. not true. What happened? Why didn't that promise right. get fulfilled?
Right. Well, let me answer that question a second and finish about the MK Ultra.
Of course.
Briefly, what this memoir showed was that chief of the high CIA official who Office of Medical Services within CIA said, was recounting the beginning of the torture program and said there was a group within the Office of Technical Services within the CIA that was very enamored of MK Ultra, had followed it, that there were studies that had been done that we've never seen, and that when they got the chance, they were very excited to implement aspects of that again. This is all, by the way, in a story I did called something like Why There Were Two Torture Programs at the CIA had two different torture programs. One was a program, and this happened at Guantanamo too, where people were routinely tortured. But if you look at the story of Muhammad al-Qahtani, the original, when Time magazine published the interrogation log, other interrogations were very highly monitored and medically monitored. Why was that? Right, because one of that was wherever you find the medical oversight, you're finding probably experiments being done. When you find the torture without the medical oversight, and you know, and all the different signing off by legal teams about what could be done, that's just a torture. That's another kind of torture program. Anyway, to come back to the politicization and why Guantanamo has disappeared off the people's radar. Well, for one thing, a lot of people were over the years released, many of them under the Bush administration, and then another smaller but significant amount under the Obama administration. And just, but there was an attempt, you know, I can't say, you know, the Democrats, the Democratic Party joined with, you know, the Republican Party was always pro Guantanamo. You know, and put that forth, you know, right, you know, as part of the kind of, you know, patriotic, jingoistic fervor that they always use. But the Democrats aren't far behind them. And the Democrats just were not willing to stand up. Their standard bearer, Barack Obama, told the world that torture had happened at Guantanamo. We did some bad stuff, Obama said, but time to move on. Don't look back. Let's move on. And the press, and the editors who run the press and the publishers, you know, loyally followed along with what he said, and it fell off the wayside. And I've known cases in which reporters were reprimanded for trying to follow the Guantanamo story and were chased off of it. I know that when Scott Horton, as I mentioned before, wrote a landmark article, you know, questioning that there were suicides at Guantanamo in 2006, and that these were perhaps the result of experiments or at least other interrogations that were taking place by the CIA at a different facility at the Guantanamo base. He was attacked. The publication was attacked in the pages of Adweek, which was one of the top two advertising journals in the publication, you know, in the American media field, thereby signaling to everybody who is a publisher that Madison Avenue, who pays for a lot of what happens in the press, was not going to stand for this kind of bullshit, pardon me, coming from investigative journalists, that they were going to be chased off, they would be vilified, they would be, you know, labeled conspiracy theorists, you know, and their work would be rendered illegitimate. And as a result, people backed off. The one person who stayed with it, Carol Rosenberg at the Miami Herald, now at the New York Times, interestingly discovered in an interview she gave to someone, she was handpicked by DOD to come and be at Guantanamo and to cover it. And she, you know, so that already makes me a little suspicious, but she's done some good work over the years. And obviously, you know, it takes some courage to stand up to DOD even a little bit at times. But she and others, when it comes to the all these deaths at Guantanamo, you know, never went farther than what the DOD handout told her to say. Not that they told her to say it, but that's what she said.
Yeah. And the Trump administration in 2018, he signed an executive order keeping Gitmo open indefinitely, right? That was his connection to all of this. Right. To the best of your understanding, do you feel programs like we've been talking about, do you feel that they're still ongoing with your research and what you found out? Do you think it's still ongoing to this day?
Yeah, I believe it is. At Guantanamo with its prisoners, 19 years, is just a handful left. They're aging prisoners. And so far as Guantanamo makes the press anymore, it's all about how we've got these aging prisoners. What are we going to do? We need to provide geriatric services. We need to provide more cardiac services. Then in a sense, we now have a longitudinal study going on about what happens to people when you torture them, hold them in indefinite detention, how does that affect them? How does that break them down? You know, if you look at anybody here who's followed psychological or medical research knows that the journals are filled with experimental groups of no more than about a couple dozen people. Well, Guantanamo, we have about 40. They're under a microscope there. They're studied. They are given, you know, they're looked at by doctors, and these records are kept. You know, any other, you know, and it's also known who was given what drugs, you know. Do I know that there's a longitudinal study going on? No, I don't. But it's, you know, given the history of Guantanamo, it's a reasonable assumption. And I hate to say, my reasonable assumptions over the years have not always, but often played out, particularly when it comes to the issue of experimentation at Guantanamo. There are still some very enticing strands that go on about that. Some of them have to do with the people who died. Some of them have to do with the major case, the signal cases of torture that the government used to that first became famous and were the first people who the CIA and the Department of Defense implemented their new torture program on. In the CIA, it was a man by the name of Abu Zubaydah. And then held at Guantanamo, it was a man by the name of Muhammad al-Qahtani, who the government later admitted we tortured in Guantanamo. Mm-hmm. Nobody was ever, by the way, prosecuted for that torture, even though it's a capital offense. But anyway, both of these individuals had histories of mental illness and severe head injury prior to their capture, prior to their torture. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, probabilities. What is the probability in a random group of individuals drawn to Guantanamo, by random in the sense that they supposedly weren't deliberately picked, that the two people who would become the first cases of and would test cases for the torture programs would both be people with significant head injury history? Which, by the way, MKUltra, if you look back, there were MKUltra studies done about head injuries and studying people with head, you know, severe head injuries. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know, but it's a little bit, it's just a step too far for me. Yeah. Certainly it's reasonable that doubt or reasonable suspicion can be raised. These things should all have been investigated by either Congress or an independent commission, but there are no investigations going on. So perhaps we will never know.
I just want to jump in on that point. Why do you think that is? I mean, both sides of the aisle, I would think, would want to deal with issues like this, maybe not put it into the mainstream media and get a lot of attention to it. But just with what you see they look into, you would imagine that somebody would want to politicize it in the process, I'm sure, but research it. Why do you think that this is just off their radar?
Off of Congress's radar?
Yeah.
Yeah. That would be a whole show, perhaps, and perhaps probably it would be worthy, you know. I mean, there have been people in the past who have attempted to, you know, going all the way back to the Church Committee hearing, but also in the 1990s, even as late as the 1990s, there were attempts to do that. And I mentioned the Armed Services Committee hearings in 2007, 2008, and then there was the Senate Intelligence Committee's investigation and review, really, of the CIA program. And just to take the latter, you can see how that became attacked by the CIA. It was where the investigators were spied upon, you know, and threatened with prosecution. Why don't people do it? The bottom line is they're afraid. You know, they just want to get by. You know, I want to make a living. You know, I'm afraid for my family. I'm afraid for my future, my career. You know, it's not a way to move forward. It's a way to move backwards. If you get attacked by government or right wing forces to do that,
Did you experience a lot of pushback with the research you did and the phone calls you were making, the FOIAs, and ultimately the book? Did you get it too?
I can't know for sure if these things were aimed at me, but my offices began to be broken into. This is back in 2013 or so. Mm-hmm. And my car was ran into, you know, too, when I went to go get a cup of coffee and came back early in the morning, no one on the streets, and I come back and the car is smashed and no one around and no one saw anything. This was all happening in a small period of time when I was writing articles about one of the suicides, Adnan Latif, a man who was really driven insane inside Guantanamo. And by the way, half of these people, probably you could say at least half, if not more, were essentially driven insane. You asked, were they suicide? I mean, some of these people were genuinely suicidal. There were hundreds, according to the government itself, there were hundreds of suicide attempts made at Guantanamo. And they were the people inside Guantanamo were very intent on preventing suicide. It doesn't look good. You know, definitely it would be bad. And you lose your source of information or their propaganda value. It would be a negative propaganda event from their standpoint to lose somebody. But nevertheless, you know, you've got. So how do people die at Guantanamo? I think some of them may have been victimized by guards. Who just wanted people to die. Two of them, Al-Hanashi and Latif, were very difficult from the standpoint of guards and medical staff prisoners. They were blatantly psychotic. They lashed out. They were uncooperative. They were heavily sedated at times. They made multiple suicide attempts. When the autopsy report on Al-Hanashi came out, I mean, his head, you know, he had lacerations on his head from banging his head and one from literally trying to kill himself by running headlong into an iron bolt on a gate. They were put on suicide watch multiple times. They were on heavy psychotic medications or antidepressant medications. Latif supposedly saved some of those and killed himself by overdose, supposedly. Or perhaps he was provided with the overdose and finally died the way that at times he wanted to. Al-Hanashi similarly supposedly strangled himself to death with a strip off of his underwear. all while supposedly being looked in on every 3 minutes and under, you know, video camera surveillance in the Guantanamo's behavioral health unit.
And you had written about in your book how those systems, maybe not that exact system, but systems to monitor them were shut down sometimes minutes before a suicide would take place. Do I have that right?
Well, at Guantanamo, there's something called the Detainee Information Management System. That is a computerized system in which everything a detainee does is logged into that system. When they ate, when they slept, when they burped, you know, when they prayed to Allah, when they talked to a guard, when they bowed down, you know, when they stood up, when they laid down. You were supposed to log every single significant thing that happened, including, by the way, when they left their cell and when they returned to their cell, of course. And when I looked at and got the FOIA information from the investigations, I discovered that in some cases, what happened, you mentioned shut down. In the case of Muhammad Al-Hanashi in 2009, the moment that he had died, somebody, we still don't know who, ordered that system to be shut down. The system is never supposed to be shut down. And it was shut down for over 24 hours. So whatever was happening among the detainees, we don't know. I believe they learned their lesson from the detainee who died 2 years prior, Abdul Al-Amri. In that case, the investigators trying to understand what happened in his death. And by the way, he was found hanging from a cell to a grating you know, about 9 feet up off the ground or 8.5 feet up off the ground. With his hands tied snugly behind his back, I concentrate snug. The word snugly is a quote from the guard who found him. That's what he told investigators. I found his arms, his hands tied snugly behind his back. In the autopsy report, that was changed to loosely behind his back. And the actual bindings that tied him were thrown away and never subjected to forensic analysis. And the investigators never reported, or almost never reported, on the existence of those bindings in their investigation reports back to headquarters.
Wow.
Cover up?
I think that's the textbook definition of a cover up, destroying evidence, changing wording. I mean, that's
right.
That's in.
And I mentioned the DIMS. What happened was, the people they investigated said, yeah, he was supposed to come to it. We see he was supposed to come to an interrogation that morning. He died at lunchtime at noon, essentially. Where was he? He was supposed to go to the interrogator. They went to the interrogator. The interrogator said, no, interrogation was canceled. He had bad hemorrhoids. People were going to do it another day. That was the excuse, hemorrhoids. So he never came. But then we looked at the detainee information management system report, which says, no, he was taken out of his cell 5 minutes to 12. He was brought back then, strangely, about 5 minutes later. And then 5 minutes after that, he's dead. What, you know, so in other words, the records of what happened were dubious now. You couldn't count on them. In 2006, what happened is the records were tempered with, and the head counts that were done, you know, they're just like, you know, everyone, I guess, seen a prison, a movie, and they come and they count, you know, who's, you know, mm-hmm. if you're here, say I, mm-hmm. okay, they count the head. How many, you know, make sure that before we settle down for the night, all the prisoners can be accounted for. Well, those, they were done, suddenly instead of head counts that were done, they couldn't determine who made the head counts. They were supposedly logged anonymously, which I discovered later was impossible. And that the head count was falsified. And even the DOD itself admitted that the head count was falsified and yet never followed up why. And claimed that it didn't matter because the detainees were already dead. A cover-up? Yeah, I have evidence. Mm-hmm. And the DOD admits the evidence that there was tampering going on with the computer systems about what was going on with the detainees on the very night that the detainees died. And that's not an issue. And it's not just an issue to DOD. Much more damningly, it's not an issue to anyone in the press.
What motivates?
Yeah, I
don't mean to step on you there, but as we get kind of to the end here, I want to get into your personal motivation. What motivates you to push for these answers, and why do you feel, other than the obvious answer, but why do you feel the public should care about how these guys are being treated down there, where some, I'm not saying this is my argument, but some would argue, hey, look, you know, they wanted to play with fire. They want to harm America. Who cares what happens to them? What motivates you to do this? And how would you respond to people who do fire back and say stuff like that?
Well, it's a matter of social justice, and that the treatment at Guantanamo is not just limited to Guantanamo, but it bleeds over to the entire U.S. justice system. And the lack of accountability, and in fact, what we can see, and we've seen it with the protests against police abuse, and in fact, there was a lot of interplay between sometimes police department personnel in the United States and Guantanamo personnel, mm-hmm. and the Bureau of Prisons, who collaborated with the CIA and implementing torture and detention programs. That in Guantanamo isn't just a prison. It doesn't, pardon me, it matter what happens out there. It's all isolated. It is part of the Maine, as the poet John Donne said it. You know, this is affecting everybody. And to look away is to look away at what is in fact happening to all of us now. How I personally became motivated, though, was a slightly different road, because I was working with torture victims as a psychologist for an organization called Survivors International Torture Treatment Center. I mean, I don't think your listeners understand how widespread torture is, such that if throughout the United States and other parts of the world, there are in major U.S. cities, there are torture treatment centers set up to deal with the population of the traumatized, damaged torture victims, because they need specialized kind of help and psychological and often medical care. So I was volunteering and seeing some of these people and helping them with their court cases in the sense of doing psychological evaluations for asylum. And when you work with the people who've been tortured, you become sensitized to the issue of torture. And I felt that it was one way, one thing you thought you experience when you work with torture victims is a powerful sense of what it's like to be tortured and the helplessness that one feels when you're totally in the power of another. And then I experienced that as well. I experienced their helplessness, and I don't like the feeling of helplessness. Mm-hmm. And I suppose, this is a bit of self-analysis here, I suppose that some of what I do is to negate or counter the feelings of my own helplessness that I felt via them in terms of the trauma that was inflicted upon them by an all-powerful entity. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't take away from the fact that this is a matter of social justice that go together.
In a perfect world, to you, what would happen to Gitmo and those inside of it? If you had your choice, what would you want to see happen at this point?
If I had my choice, Guantanamo would be shuttered, but preserved as a crime scene, not just closed down and put away and the buildings razed or whatever they do. But, it would be teams of investigators who would be going in there to document everything that had happened. And the prisoners in Guantanamo, every single one of them, and that includes Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's also tortured as a prisoner. All of them would just be freed at this point. They were tortured. You can never get justice for these people. If some people feel it's a miscarriage of justice to let guilty people free, then they should think about who was it that made conditions so onerous, so terrible, so unjust that there was an impossibility of justice taking place for them. It was the United States government that did that. I'm not saying the United States government did 9/11. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that the United States government inflicted so much injustice upon the people it accused of it that they can never be justly prosecuted. And in fact, today, the men, here we are 19 years, they can't get a trial going because they don't even want to subject these people to regular instruments of U.S. justice because they know that the cases would be thrown out. So let's just let the people go now. And and they should be given whatever is needed to help with their readjustment from the massive torture and that they experienced in U.S. custody.
And I want to punch the point because that what you just said is very powerful. I'm not going to say I either agree or disagree. What I will say is you have something that I and probably the majority of those that are watching this don't have, and that is a firsthand look through your education background and your training, but a firsthand look of what all this does. And I hope that everybody who is listening and watching to this realizes you have a very unique but very valuable perspective to offer that. So I really do appreciate your time today. My last question for you, because I could talk to you all day, and I don't want to blow too much through the time, but I kind of smell another show between you and I, hopefully coming up, because you've been doing a lot of research. You touched on it earlier in the show about that biological warfare and the attacks during the Korean War. Can you kind of give everybody a little bit more of a taste of what you are doing now and where they can see your current work that's being published?
Right. Well, the torture work led me to investigate, because again, I wanted to look at original documents as to whether these claims of torture, tortured confessions, or the kind of the original sin of all this that created, that was reverse engineered for the U.S. torture program, I wanted to see the evidence of the confessions. I wanted to see how they looked like. Because if you look back at my writings, you'll see, even this, 10 years ago or so, I believed what the U.S. government said. But I wanted to see, very simple, I'm sure these confessions must be easy to find. No, I couldn't find them anywhere. Huh. That was bizarre. I said, there must be somewhere, it must be in a library. There must be some. Couldn't find them. I discovered the Chinese had put it out in book form, but I couldn't find one library in the United States that had it. I had to go to England to get a copy and see these documents, which today you can find more easily. Someone finally posted them online when they were published in the People's China Daily or whatever back in 1952 in a pamphlet, and somebody didn't do a great scan, but they scanned it and posted it online, so you can kind of see it. But that was remarkable, and it also pointed to cover up. And I started to look farther into the history, and I saw many of the documents about, well, it had to be that the germ warfare was not true. And when I began to look into it, I found that the major, you know, much of the major documentation of it also wasn't available. What in the world's going on? How can I determine for myself the truth value or not of this? So anyway, a lot of my work has been, and then I just got interested in that. And because it was a major event in history at that time, it made headlines in that day. And now here it is 70 years later, unavailable to be looked at. So a lot of my work has been in rooting out and bringing that information to light. And one of the most recent things I did was I discovered that the CIA itself had released 10 years ago a whole bunch of very top secret communications intelligence reports from the Korean War. And when I looked into them, I said, well, I wonder if there's anything in there about biological warfare claims. I'm just curious. Let's just see. So I started reading them all and searching through it. And wow, I did. I found more than a couple dozen of them talking about, you know, in saying from NSA kinds of intercepts. It wasn't the NSA then. It was called the Armed Forces Security Agency. But, you know, and they were documenting, hey, we're under attack. We're under attack. What should we do? We need to send us DDT. I don't know. Hey, you know, if we don't get something soon, people are going to starve because we can't, because of biological war attack, we can't get our supplies through. When people are going to, you know, units are going to starve. So wait a minute. Maybe these flyers weren't making false confessions. Not only maybe, this was definitive proof they weren't. So I'm presenting that evidence again to the American public, and I'm trying to make it, to legitimate it as far as possible, because it's an instance of our history that needs to be known. And also because we almost went to war with North Korea a few years ago. And today with the China and North Korea, China was also attacked by biological weapons by the U.S. That this we need to know before we go off the cliff here in another series of wars in Asia, which could easily be a tripwire to the big one, World War III. So I find it is very important. I feel the work I'm doing on this is very important right now.
Wow.
So I thank you for bringing it up.
Of course. I'm so fascinated by it. Last question, throw out. I know you said, go, and forgive me, the website to get the documents on Guantanamo, your website was?
Right. Guantanamo Truth, like it's all one word, GuantanamoTruth.com.
And is there any other, I know you publish on Medium under your name. Mm-hmm. Those that are watching, see the Chyron right under Jeffrey's picture here. You'll be able to just search for his name. Any other website you'd like to plug before we end here?
For a number of years, I had a blog called Invictus that I posted. It was from a Google, I think it was called, it's called teensblog.blogspot.com. So if you search for that, in those days, I blogged under the name Valtin, V-A-L-T-I-N. He was himself a torture victim, John Valtin in World War II. Interesting story, but not really germane here.
There's a couple shows that I smell coming up between us. For all of those that are watching on YouTube, I will link all of that below into the show notes. If you're listening on the more popular podcast, I don't know why people don't watch more, but you all want to listen and walk around with it on your MP3 players. If you go to theblackvault.com/show notes, that will spit out all of the show notes that I am referring to that are generally on YouTube, but also for the audio listeners, you can view it at that page there. Jeffrey, I really do appreciate your time, expertise, your knowledge, and what you are doing. And it's an important drive that you have. And I can see your passion behind it. I know my audience will be able to see it and hear it. So I wanted to just say thank you for what you do and your time with your the time today sharing all of your research and work with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me on and for all the work that you do.
It's my pleasure.
Very much appreciate it.
And thanks again. And thank you all for listening and watching. This is John Greenwald Jr. signing off. We'll see you next time.